Good afternoon. I call the Senate Housing and Homelessness Prevention Committee to order. We do have a quorum. Today we will be taking up the confirmation of the Minnesota Housing and Finance Agency Commissioner Jennifer Ho. There is a packet in each of your packets members that has letters of support for Commissioner Ho. We will be inviting the commissioner to come up and introduce herself to us, to walk through her qualifications, and then we will have time for discussion and questions from members before we vote to move her confirmation. Questions on the agenda for today, members? All right, Commissioner Ho, would you like to come up to the table, introduce yourself, and begin with your testimony?
Music. Well, thank you, Chair Port and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Lemiley Ho, and I'm the Commissioner of Minnesota Housing. I appreciate this opportunity to tell you about myself and to outline the critical housing work before us. I'm honored to serve as Minnesota Housing's commissioner, as I have for the past 4 years. It is, frankly, the best job I've ever had, and I'm honored to work with an incredibly dedicated, mission-driven team. When I was newly appointed as commissioner in 2019, it was already understood that Minnesota faced significant housing challenges. Minnesota did not have enough homes to meet demand. The racial disparity in home ownership between black and white households was one of the worst in the nation. Renters were paying more than they could afford, and too many people were at risk of losing their housing with little chance of finding something else they could afford. It was clear from day one that there was great urgency to find big solutions to fundamental problems, and then the pandemic hit. We added a public health crisis to an already existing housing crisis. The housing needs of those who make the least came into focus for the agency and for the nation. Housing became a front-page issue in a way it hadn't been since the Great Recession. The federal stimulus programs rolled out for renters first and then for homeowners. Our agency set up and ran rental and mortgage assistance programs that we built from scratch that are magnitudes larger than any previous program and that required us to be more involved in the daily operations than we ever had before. Meanwhile, we grew our agency's core work, even as staff, too, we're juggling the realities of the pandemic. It has been astonishing to be a part of, to say the least. So let me tell you a little about myself. I grew up in Fridley. My dad ran for office for both the State House and the State Senate when I was young. I remember walking the streets with him and talking to neighbors. That taught me a lot about the meaning of public service and the commitment to doing the best for your neighbors, even though he didn't win. For most of my career, even prior to government service, the work I did was with government. I worked in managed care for 10 years, largely on Medicare and Medicaid programs. For the last 24 years, I've dedicated my career to creating systems that could prevent and end homelessness and serve people who struggle to maintain their housing. I've been a leader at the local, state, and federal levels in the public, private, and nonprofit sectors, to bring together issues of healthcare, aging, disability, homelessness, and housing. From 1999 to 2010, I was the executive director of Hearth Connection, and I worked with the Minnesota legislature through 10 sessions, creating services financing to demonstrate that supportive housing works, even for people with the longest histories of homelessness. From 2010 to 2013, I served as the deputy director of the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness, and from 2013 to 2017 as senior advisor to the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development during the Obama administration. I've developed deep relationships with partners and significant experience with many systems that must come together to support the construction of affordable housing, support successful home ownership, address the challenges of providing housing and services for people experiencing homelessness. I spent many years working on the issue of ending veterans' homelessness, first at the federal level. I've brought those lessons to our efforts here in Minnesota to help us accomplish this goal. In 2018, I was asked by the Trump administration to serve as the chair of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Advisory Committee on homeless veterans. Together with a dozen other experts from across the country, we advised the Secretary about the progress we're making and provided recommendations of where things could be strengthened or improved. I have worked to prevent and end homelessness in urban communities, suburban communities, rural communities, and on tribal land. Minnesota has egregious racial disparities in housing across the board. I am working to achieve more equitable outcomes. Every commissioner gets a curveball, and for me and my team, it was the pandemic and its economic impacts, layered with the racial reckoning that followed George Floyd's murder, along with the ongoing housing shortage that plagues our state. Minnesota faces long-standing housing challenges, a shortage of affordable housing, housing instability, income inequality, a growing number of people living outside, loss of affordable, unsubsidized housing to market forces that's pushing up rents, and one of the largest homeownership gaps in the nation. In my first year as commissioner in 2019, I spent significant time on the road, traveling to every corner of the state. While the housing needs varied, every town, city, and county needs more housing. I've spent time with leaders and residents in communities like Marshall, Thief River Falls, the Grand Portage Reservation, and Rochester, to name a few. And while the communities vary greatly, the needs are consistent. We need more of everything as it relates to housing. We need to build new single-family homes and apartments. We need to preserve the ones we have. We need more market-rate housing that the private sector builds, and we need housing that is affordable to those who make the very least, our role in government. To get there, we need to innovate and do things we've never done in housing. That goes for the housing sector as a whole, but I believe that Minnesota housing can lead the way. My work follows my mantra, go big so all Minnesotans can go home. To get there, we need big goals, hard work, and a lot of funding. This year's budget proposal is an example of going big. And I'm proud to say that I helped craft the largest housing budget any governor has ever proposed. I've fought for more housing resources, and I'm grateful that some of the largest housing infrastructure bonds have been authorized for the agency during my time. While the pandemic response has dominated the public aspects of Minnesota Housing's work over the past 3 years, the core work of the agency has continued unabated. The agency has seen growth and success across its divisions during my tenure that represent extensive work with the legislature. In our single family division, we've seen the highest number of homes purchased with our financing by first-time homebuyers in each of the past 4 years, despite the pandemic and low inventory. We set a stretch goal to make 40% of our lending to first-time homebuyers who are Indigenous, Black, and other people of color in our 2021 to 2023 strategic plan. I'm pleased to report that we met that goal a year early. That's twice the state average among conventional mortgage lenders who are making about 21% of their first-time homebuyer loans to people of color. We're making progress on manufactured housing in the state by adding staff and creating new programs. In 2022, we selected nearly $10 million to make infrastructure improvements to manufactured home communities across the state. We're funding almost all of the organizations that seek support to build new single-family homes because the state has such a need for them, and we strive to support more single-family development. As for multifamily accomplishments, we have indeed gone big, holding two of the largest funding rounds ever in 2019 and 2020. Nearly half of the resources committed by the agency are committed to Greater Minnesota. We've innovated to preserve more affordable homes in Greater Minnesota and are incentivizing different housing construction techniques geared toward reducing the cost of housing. We have remained nimble during the pandemic, such as when we announced $87 million in projects using housing infrastructure bonds in December 2020, when the legislature passed a bonding bill just a few months earlier. Overall, the agency delivered about $1.9 billion in all resources in 2021. That's likely to reach nearly $2.2 billion when we report on 2022. Of the $2.2 billion, only $125 million is state appropriated, to give you a sense of how we leverage Minnesota's investment in housing. Since I started with the agency in 2019, I've placed racial equity at the forefront of the agency's decision-making. Here are a few examples of how I've done so. I've overseen the implementation of changes to how the agency awards resources to better serve communities of color. We've intentionally expanded the network of housing developers we work with, selecting experienced, affordability-minded developers of color who had not worked with the agency before. I've added a director of equity and inclusion to the agency, a new role now embedded in my servant leadership team, recognizing that a leader of equity and inclusion must have a seat at the leadership table. Her role is not to do the work of racial equity for us, but to work across the agency to build everyone's skills in this area. I've worked with agency leaders to build racial equity into the program design of our federal rental and mortgage assistance programs. First come, first served, it turns out, is not an equitable model. The pandemic has created some of the greatest challenges on the job, requiring us to design new direct assistance programs in record time. These have been the largest direct assistance programs the agency has ever administered. It is unusual for Minnesota Housing to make payments direct to property owners to cover overdue rent on behalf of individual renters. It is rare that Minnesota Housing would negotiate directly with banks and lenders to cover individual homeowners' overdue mortgage payments. But we have designed from scratch three new programs to do just that, delivering hundreds of millions of dollars to help tens of thousands of Minnesotans at risk of losing their housing. I'm going to talk through the three programs we've created with emergency state and federal assistance dollars. First, the COVID-19 Housing Assistance Program. Second, Rent Help MN. And third, Home Help MN. The scale of these new programs has been staggering. The 2020 program alone was 10 times larger than any direct assistance program the agency had ever administered. That was the COVID-19 Housing Assistance Program. The agency designed and ran the $100 million program with federal CARES Act funds in record time. Doing so required strong agency leadership and tremendous community partnerships. Our partners and agency staff worked nights and weekends to make this happen. It was not easy by any means, but in the end, we helped over 22,000 households and paid $58 million to property owners and utility companies. In 2021, we launched Rent Help MN. We designed and ran this emergency rental assistance program with over $500 million in federal funds. That massive influx of federal funds changed the nature, scope, and scale at which the agency operates. We built the new program from the ground up based on complex and evolving Treasury guidance. We did so while deep in the pandemic. We knew there would be public scrutiny for years to come, so we needed to have strong oversight mechanisms. We conducted an aggressive public outreach campaign to reach those with the most barriers to applying. Now, granted, the program was not without its challenges. We were not the first state to open or the first to make payments. But over time, we caught up. As other states opened their programs, we had a chance to learn from them. Ultimately, the program received over 100,000 applications, and the process of processing those applications was largely individual and iterative. We had to balance issues related to speed, cost, and quality throughout the entire program. In the end, we delivered $450 million to property owners and utility companies to cover overdue rent and other housing expenses. We issued more than 100,000 payments. We assisted more than 50,000 Minnesota households who are at risk of losing their housing due to the pandemic. I am proud of how fast the program was designed, launched, and managed in the face of changing federal guidance and significant reporting and oversight for a brand new program set up in mere months. The U.S. Treasury Department recognizes Minnesota's program efficiency, too. Treasury has, in fact, reallocated funds from other states to Minnesota Housing four times, the most recent being yesterday. We're working within the Treasury guidelines now to determine how best to put these remaining funds to work. In 2022, we designed and launched Home Help MN, the federal homeowner assistance fund, again administered by the Treasury. This $100 million program will remain open for applications from homeowners who are behind on their mortgage or taxes as long as funds are available. Even now, we're setting up the next federal program to prevent and end homelessness through the American Rescue Plan, and we'll be deploying the last amounts of emergency rental assistance. The emergency housing work continues, and it will for some time. Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan have proven themselves to be champions of housing stability, speaking up for those who make the least, those who are most at risk of losing their housing, and those sleeping in shelters or on the streets. They care deeply about creating and preserving housing Minnesotans can afford. As we speak, they are releasing a budget that includes more than $1 billion in the next biennium for Minnesota housing, and more than $1.5 billion for housing stability over 4 years across 9 agencies. Regarding the budget, I'd be happy to speak to any program areas in more detail, but I believe that getting the magnitude of commitments from the governor and lieutenant governor are what qualify me to be the commissioner at this unique moment in time. In 2019, I was asked to lead an agency that is highly regarded as one of the best housing finance agencies in the country by our peers, national financial advisors, and the bond market rating agencies. That stellar reputation continues today. I have built the servant leadership team the agency needs to meet today's challenges. Together with your support, we will keep more renters in their homes and more homeowners out of foreclosure. We'll protect the people who have suffered the most from the economic fallout from COVID and who have faced the most adversity in their housing experience for generations. We'll continue to make progress on the state's lack of housing by investing in construction and preservation of homes that people can afford. The work of Minnesota Housing takes place in every corner of the state, across the Twin Cities Metro, and throughout greater Minnesota. Our work ranges from helping people who are sleeping outside to helping low-income seniors who want to age in their communities. Alongside my deputy commissioner, assistant commissioners, and colleagues at Minnesota Housing, I am on a mission to deliver the loans, the programs, and the housing investments that will put us on a path to go big. Really big, so all Minnesotans can go home. I am filled with hope and optimism as we embark on this legislative session with a once-in-a-generation opportunity to invest in housing at scale. Because I now have a 4-year track record as commissioner, you can base your vote not on my competence in the work I did before I arrived, but on what I've done with the agency. The last 4 years as commissioner have taught me many things. You listen to the people who most need what you do. You make sure that you distribute funds that target communities that are the most impacted. You rise to the occasion when your agency is asked to do something way beyond what you've ever done before. You listen to your critics. You strive every day to do your best with gratitude to your staff, your partners, and your allies. It is a privilege of a lifetime to serve as the state's housing commissioner. It would be an extraordinary honor to receive your support and continue to do this work. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Ho. Members, we'll move to questions in just a moment. I do want to note for the record that per Senate rules, Senator Pa is participating remotely. Also want to draw your attention to the packets that we had and note for the folks who are not in the room or those who might not have access to all of these that there are letters of support for Commissioner Ho from the Minnesota Home Ownership Center, Homes for All, the Family Housing Fund, the MHFA Board, the National Council of State Housing Agencies, D.W. Jones Incorporated, Minnesota Housing Partnership, the Home Ownership Minnesota, Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, the Project for Pride in Living, and Common Bonds Communities. Those are all in your packets, members, and have been posted online as well, I believe. Members, questions for the commissioner? Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being with us this morning, or this afternoon, actually. Everything blends together when it's fast-paced. You, in your testimony this afternoon here, you referenced several programs, but among them the COVID-19 Housing Assistance Program, Rent Help, MN, and both of these programs have had or did have unfortunate rollouts, challenging rollouts by MHFA. The governor has made proposals for additional dollars and programs, and given the history then of these two programs, what can you tell us to help reassure us about more stable and effective rollouts of future programs that are being proposed?
Commissioner.
Chair Port, Senator Lucero, thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. I actually believe that history will show that they were very successful rollouts and administration of those programs, but they operated in the context of a period of time where there was extraordinary urgency and people were feeling the pain. And that includes the property owners that were having a hard time paying their own mortgages, as well as the renters in those communities. The ability to stand up a program that we weren't required to stand up with the COVID-19 housing assistance program was us trying to figure out how to step into a problem that wasn't there, and then to have the Congress come behind the original CARES Act in the Consolidated Budget Act with money for emergency rental assistance, but with a whole different set of rules, means that we had to stand up another program that effectively did the same thing as what we had done with the state's CARES Act money. I'd point out that President Trump signed the Consolidated Budget Act into law the last week of December. A new president was put into office, I think, on January 20th. The new Treasury Secretary told us to hold still while they looked at the guidance that the new administration wanted to put out. Guidance was put out on the 21st of February, and we opened Rent Help MN to the public 2 months later on April 20th. If you are behind on your bills, does that feel like an eternity? Absolutely. If you are state government, does that break land speeds for implementing a new program? I promise it does. If we weren't in a crisis, if people weren't feeling the pain of not being able to pay their bills, we usually would have implemented a program of that size. First, as a pilot, we would have done an incredible amount of testing before we had taken something like that to scale. But the urgency of the pandemic and people not being able to pay their bills required us to move at a speed that I would say is uncomfortable for government, and to put getting money out the door ahead of having everything be perfect at the time that we opened. So I appreciate the question. I believe our success on that is reinforced by the fact that the Treasury has taken money away from other states that haven't been able to use the funding effectively, and on four occasions have given that money to Minnesota in recognition of the fact that we operated a very efficient program. I understand the scale of the budget proposals that the governor has set forth is huge. And I guess the good thing is that we propose them in ways that they build upon existing programs that we have, as opposed to having to do a lot of it from scratch, and that we'll have some time to be able to put it in place, because unlike the crisis that so many property owners and renters were feeling during that period of time in 2020, 2021, 2022, we'll have the opportunity to use existing mechanisms of the agency and just be able to say yes to more programs when we've had to say no in the past. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Follow-up, Lucero?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, the numbers that the governor is proposing are very large, and that's in part creating much concern, because when taxpayers across Minnesota, not necessarily within your agency, but across multiple state agencies and government, have seen waste, fraud, and abuse, lack of efficiency in taxpayer dollars flowing through the coffers of government, it does cause for concern when, again, such very large numbers are being proposed by the governor. So I appreciate that. Another question. So near and dear to my heart and to the hearts of many Minnesotans is clearly the cost of housing, whether you're renting or home ownership. And housing experts, as we've actually had in the committee here, housing experts and realtors continue to know that the supply of new homes, especially starter homes, is extremely limited, making it hard for anyone to buy a starter home. The Federal Reserve noted, quote, "Expanding the housing supply through new housing construction is the single most effective way to ensure long-term housing affordability." And so my question is, what suggestions do you offer, whether they be within something within your authority as an agency or recommendations you can make to the legislature, to help ease as quick as possible the supply shortage that we have, beyond just throwing more money and programs, because you can throw more money if there's lack of supply. It doesn't help a lot for people to get into homes that don't exist. So again, the question is, what steps can you take, or what do you recommend to help tackle the supply shortage?
Commissioner?
Chair Port and Senator Lucero, I couldn't agree more that the supply issue is what's driving a lot on the cost issue. We've been down on supply ever since the Great Recession, and it's not going to resolve itself on its own. So I think investment in supply, and investment in supply that's targeting first-time homebuyers. I always kind of chuckle to myself at the term starter home. My parents at 83 are still living in the starter home that they bought in 1965, and I don't think they ever thought of it as a starter home. It was just their home. I think that one of the things that we can do, especially with the governor's budget proposal around putting $100 million into the Economic Development and Workforce Challenge Program, is help communities build housing at a faster pace that really is targeted towards people who earn enough to pay a mortgage but haven't been able to find a home that they can afford. So I think investment in supply is a very critical part of this, and it's not kind of a one-and-done job. It's something we're going to have to do over time. But if we don't invest in supply, then it is going to be costlier and costlier to build if we wait to try to do it later.
Follow-up, Senator Lucero. Senator Dreheim.
Thank you, Chair Port, and thank you, Commissioner. But before we go to the Commissioner, if I could, I know Senator Rest might get mad at this, but I'd like to congratulate my seatmate here on her baby, and it's good to see her on the camera. So, Senator Paugh, congratulations. I wanted to grab that before she had to run and do something with the young one. So, anyway, Commissioner, if I could, the legislative auditor is coming out with a report within weeks on, I think it's just the rent help portion. And just wondering what your thoughts are and what their findings are going to be, and, you know, are there any lessons that we can learn? We all know it was a difficult time for everybody involved, very hectic. But any foreshadowing, if you could, on that report?
Commissioner.
Chair Port, Senator Dreheim, thank you. I believe that you're all aware that when I'm in possession of a draft report from the legislative auditor, by statute, I am not allowed to share anything that's in a report. I am allowed to share with you that I'm in possession of a draft report from the legislative auditor, and that we'll be meeting with them in person to talk through some of the language in their draft report. I believe that that's probably all that I should say because I am in possession of the draft report. I don't want to be coy. I just don't want to upset the legislative auditor, who was very clear about what I could and couldn't share once I got the draft report.
Follow up, Senator Dreheim. Senator Russ.
Thank you. And I really, Commissioner, respect your or appreciate your respect for the jurisdiction of the Legislative Audit Commission. We absolutely do not allow those documents to be discussed publicly, and it is in statute. However, members, certainly of the Audit Commission, and I would think other members too, the closer we get to the release of the report, can receive a confidential briefing. And it is not in writing. Nobody sees the report until it's released. And that's done online, usually at 9:00 in the morning. And then everybody has the same information at the same time. But any of us can request a confidential briefing from the principals in the legislative auditor's office that conducted the review. So that procedure was decided on a number of years ago and actually has worked fairly well, so that we do not have biased early releases from one side or the other or the third side or whatever of those reports. So please do not share any information that's in that report. It's more or less against the law.
Thank you, Senator Rust. Senator Housley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could take a note to congratulate Senator Patu, I'm so excited to meet the little Sienna. Congratulations. Commissioner, so MHFA has traditionally seriously underfunded home ownership in Minnesota. Historically, I know you alluded to this a little earlier, but MHFA only allocates 4% of its resources to fund construction of affordable home ownership. And this is particularly disturbing considering Minnesota has the fourth worst racial disparity gap in home ownership in the country. Based off some of the governor's budget and the majority's bills, I hope this is starting to change. Can you state that home ownership should be a focus of MHFA?
Commissioner?
Chair Port, Senator Housley. I absolutely think that home ownership creation, production, preservation is a very important part of what the agency does. I absolutely agree that we need more single-family homes and that we have a role to play in that. I am in the single-family annual consolidated funding rounds that we do. Nearly 90% of the organizations who come to us with proposals, we say yes to. Of the $1.6 billion in program resources from our federal fiscal year 2021, $1.2 billion, or 75%, went to affordable home ownership, primarily as home mortgages and down payment and closing cost assistance. But absolutely, we think the opportunity to participate more in the development of single-family homes, and that's where we think that the partnership that we have with the legislature and the line items that we have in the governor's budget would contribute towards that. So very much agree that we should be doing more in this space.
Thank you, Commissioner. Follow-up, Senator Housley?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for that answer. I'm just hoping going forward that MHFA can prioritize new home ownership, and you sort of briefly alluded to that again, so thank you.
Commissioner?
Chair Port and Senator Housley, thank you. And, you know, we operate under federal rules and with the state appropriated dollars by seeing significant increases in our production programs for home ownership. I believe that we can move in that direction. But I have to work within the rules of the low-income housing tax credit, you know, the greatest source of federal capital that we have available to us. But we would welcome the opportunity to increase our state appropriated production programs, and you make the investment, and we will fund the organizations that are able to do that around the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, other questions? Senator Rust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've been reeling still from the effects of the pandemic over the last few years. And I wonder if you would give further comment on what kind of lessons does your agency taking into your planning for the next 4 years for your agency under this governor and lieutenant governor? What could you comment more on what his vision is and what kinds of not only visionary kinds of things, but accountability protocols that are so important to us have become even more important to us in the last couple of years. What is that vision? How do we hold ourselves accountable? How do we hold you accountable and your agency? What's it going to look like 4 years from now?
Commissioner?
Chair Port, Senator Rust, thank you so much for the question. And I think I'll use this as an occasion to congratulate Senator Paugh on the birth of her child.
We all do. Yes.
And my complete amazement at the fact that you are with us in committee today. Because it's a good segue. I mean, obviously the vision of the governor and lieutenant governor is to make Minnesota the best place to raise a kid. And getting housing right is absolutely critical to being able to do that, because when Families don't have a stable home that they can afford in the community of their choice. It creates a lot of other problems around raising a child, a kid being in school, a parent working, health issues, and other issues. So the overall vision is to make Minnesota the best place to raise a kid. I think as I reflect on what I've learned in the first 4 years, and most definitely in the last three of the pandemic, it's that it's one thing to be kind of a wholesale bank that invests kind of in large-scale developments, and it's another to be a retail bank that is providing emergency assistance at a household level. It's one thing to talk about communities most impacted and disparities in housing. It's another one to work with families that have never had a crisis before and had to ask for help from government, but also other families who have been in crisis repeatedly because their incomes have not given them anything other than a paycheck to paycheck way of getting by. And so I think our administration of emergency rental assistance programs during a pandemic, during all the crises, really made the agency far more attuned to the needs at an individual household level. It made us understand how precarious the rental situation is for so many working families and the complexities of the situations that they were in when they came to us for need. I think it has given the agency a much deeper appreciation of the community-based organizations that help these communities navigate government assistance and government programs. We partner with organizations, grassroots community-based organizations that we never partnered with before, to help be the translator of government assistance. And I think it hammered home, what we've known, but has moved it from kind of a tier three issue to a tier one issue, that if we don't get housing right, it's really hard to get anything else right. That was no more evident than when the public health best practice was to stay at home, and some folks didn't have one. You take on the responsibility when you take a leadership position in government or an elected leadership position in government. You take on the responsibility of transparency and accountability. It just comes with the job. Nobody was scrutinizing timelines for getting a program up and running when I ran a nonprofit running a new pilot program. But you take on just a different responsibility in government. It comes with the job. And, it came with the job, with sirens blazing and bright lights shining and, hundreds of millions of dollars to do new things, in a really big way. I think what I learned is if you surround yourself with committed, talented, competent leaders who are willing to work 100 hours a week, week after week, month after month, because people are in pain and they needed help, and they were willing to do it when everybody was yelling, but they just kept focused on why are we doing this and who are we trying to help, that the way you succeed is you surround yourself with talented staff and you support them. You surround yourself with talented partners and you listen to them and you support them in what they're doing. I hope for the state of just the health of Minnesota, we are never operating at that volume, with that urgency and that much pain ever again. But having been through that and come out as being recognized as having done a pretty darn good job, all things considered, I have a fair amount of confidence that in a deliberately established budget, that we could talk about how to do the things that the agency has historically done incredibly well and figure out how to do them at an unprecedented scale. I'm looking forward to the second term.
Thank you.
Senator Dreheim.
Thank you, Chair Port. Commissioner last year in our committee bill, we had inserted some funding out of Pool 3. And I don't think that's ever been done before. And I know the agency was against the concept of using Pool 3. And, you know, to me, the elected officials are supposed to set the budgets and the use of funds. Can you just elaborate your thoughts on the Pool 3 funds and maybe for the new members, just explain these goofy pools, because they're the only agency I think that uses pools, so they understand where you get the resources from, and you do earn those resources. But just give me a little bit of your thoughts, especially for the newer members, on if you agree with that concept we did last year or not, and kind of elaborate. Thank you.
Commissioner?
Chair Port, Senator Dreheim, I remember those conversations well. For members who are newer, I look forward to sitting with you if I haven't had a chance to do it, but obviously much more over the course of the session, and happy to come in one-on-one anytime. State housing finance agencies are basically banks with the authority to issue bonds and therefore an obligation to bondholders. And so the reason that state housing finance agencies are different than other state agencies is that we have to run a bank. And we always have to be running a bank with our 10-year, 20-year, 30-year obligations from the money we raise on the bond market or the tax credit syndicators who are putting money into deals. And so one of the reasons that state housing finance agencies are set up with an independent board of directors that's there to oversee the agency's transactions and financing is because it was believed that pulling those decisions outside of the political process made sense in terms of ensuring that we were in a good position to honor our long-term obligations. As a bank, we do issue bonds to raise money. We allocate tax credits that brings money into the field, and we manage federal appropriations and state appropriations that flow through the agency. As a bank, we do lending, and we also do grants. Some of our lending is deferred. Some of it is 0%. Some of it is interest-bearing. And so when people have an interest-bearing or a deferred loan and they pay us back, that is part of the economic cycle of any state housing finance agency. Because we are basically operating the state's housing bank, we are able to use the earnings on the payback, the difference between the cost of issuing bonds and backing mortgages, for example, in order to be fully self-funded in terms of agency operating. I don't need to come here and tell you that I will probably need to hire at least 20 more staff to implement what is just in the starting position of the governor's budget proposal. We don't have to have a conversation around that this session because I have the earnings of the bank that allow me to make investments in technology, investment in agency operating, investment in agency staff. That has been particularly useful when the housing market is volatile. There are different times where the agency's resources are appropriately deployed in different ways based on what's happening in the housing market. Right now, we're seeing a lot of projects that we selected last year because of what's happening with the inflationary pressures, the labor market, supply chain. They have a financing gap when it's time to close. The flexibility of my housing investment fund, affectionately known as Pool 3, is that I can tap the housing investment fund to respond to both the right now needs, the midterm needs, and the long-term needs of the agency. I can tap the housing investment fund in order to make sure that we're doing the type of lending that returns earnings to the agency in order to continue to grow what we do. Our financial model of being able to plow that money back into what we do is one of the things that makes us the strongest in the country And when a lot of the housing finance agencies saw their mortgage lending grind to a halt as a result of the recession, our model was unique such that we were able to continue with production and continue despite all the volatility that was in the economy. So I believe that when Congress and the Treasury authorized housing finance agencies, when this was signed into law by Governor Wendell Anderson in the 1970s, the idea of partial independence from the legislative body was to make sure that the oversight of the bank was being handled independently of the politics of the Capitol. And, you know, we have the opportunity with discussions around the biennial budget and the bonding bill to have different priorities at different times, depending on what's going on in the market and depending on the priorities of the people that are in the chairs at the time. But the fundamental operation of the bank and the ability of the bank to be nimble, to be responsive to different housing needs at different times, I think is absolutely critical. And for those resources to be directed by the legislature when they're not resources that were allocated by the legislature, I just think that that was part of what it was that the Congress and the legislature were trying to avoid when they created the agency as an independent body with an independent board of directors in the first place.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Draham.
Thank you. I'm going to switch directions, Chair, if that's okay.
Sure.
Thank you for your answer, Commissioner. You know, I've been kind of a broken record on that pathway to home ownership. And I think we all realize there's other pieces to the puzzle in the housing sector. But we really tried to push that single family homes. And part of what we did was with the bonds, trying to have that a new use for the agency to promote and to push out there. You know, we did the manufactured homes, which I think is off to a good start. What do you plan to do in the next 2 years, the next biennium here, to help that sector of the equilibrium? I know we have a whole bunch of other issues we got to work on, and I know you're very passionate about those. But what are we going to do to close that home ownership gap? And how are you going to use that ability for the HIBs for that single family?
Commissioner?
Chair Port and Senator Draheim. Yes, I don't consider it a broken record. I consider it an oldie and a goodie in terms of the discussions around home ownership. I will say that the housing infrastructure bonds were originally created around rental market production, where the developer and the ownership interest remains the same throughout the life of the property. And so the idea that you have a bondholder obligation of 30 years, you have a developer who's going to own the property for 30 years, it kind of works out not dissimilar to those of us who are homeowners, how we think about our own mortgages. When we and then we had been using the housing infrastructure bonds for community land trusts, and that also was very helpful in terms of the acquisition of land for land trust properties. Again, where the land trust was going to be the holder of that land in perpetuity, it made sense with the timing of the housing infrastructure bonds. And we were very interested when we put the new use for single family development and housing infrastructure bonds into play. The challenge that our nonprofit developers of single-family homes encountered is that when they build single-family homes, they actually intend to turn around and sell them to a homeowner. But there's still a 30-year bondholder obligation that the nonprofit developer then has to hold on to on their financial statements long after the home has been sold to an individual family. So the structure of the housing infrastructure bonds didn't really anticipate the fact that it was a short-term transaction, more of a construction loan, and less of a long-term transaction. You know, I am grateful to PRG and other organizations that were willing to be the first out of the gates. Being the first out of the gates oftentimes isn't fun. They stuck with us. I know that they are building and they're making it work. If we were to continue using housing infrastructure bonds for single-family construction with the intent to have it be purchased by a homeowner, I think we would want to have a conversation about modifying the housing infrastructure bonds to be able to be used as grants. Which I would asked for another day to do a deep dive on that. I think the opportunity to grow the appropriated items where the agency can use funds as 0% deferred loans or grants is the best place right now in this surplus environment to make the infusions. And I would just point to both the Challenge Program and the Workforce and Affordable Home Ownership Program and the Manufactured Home Park Infrastructure line items in the appropriations in the governor's budget as important places to do that. We will continue to work within the letter of the law to see if we can continue to use it. I do believe in our 2022 single-family selections, the vast majority, if not all, of the single-family selections that we applied housing infrastructure bonds to were to community land trusts where they kind of have a proven track record of working more easily. But certainly look forward to more conversations around this. But I just think that, yeah, at the end of the day, not every line item is the best tool for every challenge. And I think that for single-family home construction with the intent to have it be owned by an individual family, we just have to think about what the best mechanism for that is. And right now, it's a challenge.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Senator Dreheim, I share your concern on this, and we will definitely have a day where we will discuss this in depth in our committee. One follow-up, Senator Dreheim.
Thank you, Chair Port. Actually, it's a new subject.
Sure.
Because I feel like there's one subject that is kind of close to home for me. We had a lot of discussion, of course, with rent control over the last couple of years. You know, during the session last year, the agency was kind of quiet and noncommittal on it, and then this off session, you did come out with a recommendation for the agency for rent control, which was a little disappointing because we had asked during the session, you know, what your thoughts were on that as an agency, and we really didn't get a response. And I understand sometimes you got to dig into things, but if you could just update us on your thoughts on rent control, and then maybe for the majority of the people that don't really pay attention to the press releases, maybe just briefly comment on what you sent out. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Chair Port and Senator Dreheim, thank you for the question. I welcome the opportunity to talk about it because there's been a fair amount of confusion about what the agency did or didn't do last fall, so thank you. The agency didn't take a position on what Minneapolis and St. Paul did, the agency will continue to follow what happens there to learn from what they're doing. I am not a regulatory agency, and it didn't feel like it was appropriate for me to take a position on what the voters wanted to do in those two communities. That said, as government, when you get our money, you are agreeing to participate in a rent-regulated housing environment. That's what we do. Whether it's the low-income housing tax credit, whether it's negotiating what rents will be with a housing infrastructure bond or one of our appropriations programs, when you do a federal or state invested housing program, you are agreeing to some degree of rent regulation. So the agency kind of de facto is involved in rent regulation across the boards. During last legislative session, a normal annual occurrence happened that was not at all normal. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development issued an annual adjustment to area median incomes. Area median incomes, or a percentage thereof, are the threshold by which assistance for HUD housing programs is established, and it's the basis by which the Treasury Department establishes rent caps on housing developed with low-income housing tax credit. If you take a look at 20 years of AMI adjustments, the average annual adjustment was less than 3%. Two and a fraction. I don't want to get the fraction wrong, so I'll just go with less than 3%. The area median income adjustment in the Twin Cities metropolitan area was over 12% last year. And so people who have been living in low-income housing tax credit properties, where the property manager or owner decided to do rent maximization and increase it to the upper level of what the tax credit allowed, saw a stunning increase in their rents in a way that hadn't happened for two decades previously. I heard about it. I heard about it from those renters, and I heard it from legislators, predominantly folks who had senior housing in your districts, where your constituents were impacted by that rent increase. Now, this all happened during the final weeks of session, so it really wasn't a part of the conversation that we were having during our policy discussions during the year. But I had Senator Abler invite me up to Coon Rapids to sit with 70 residents of a senior property who talked to me about the impact of those rent increases and the fact that they were no longer going to be able to afford to live in a property they thought they were moving into to finish out their days in. So I felt it was incumbent upon the agency to at least assess what are the tools in our toolbox to be able to at least draw a line around such exorbitant rent increases, especially for people who are predominantly living on fixed incomes. I've engaged in conversations with my National Trade Association. I've engaged in conversations with HUD. I've engaged in conversations with my own team, with properties. I mean, not all owners of low-income housing tax credit properties chose to maximize the rent based on how the area median incomes had changed. We've been doing a lot of work to try to understand what's happening in the economy and what might area median income changes be this spring. We also understand that the issuance of the updated area median incomes will be delayed by HUD because of some anomaly with the American Community Survey, upon which some of that is based, that I'm happy to bring in a researcher and explain that to you, but I simply understand that it might be delayed. And so our qualified allocation plan is the federally required document that we develop in consultation with the public that governs our administration of the low-income housing tax credit program. And we were just coincidentally making changes. We have a two-year qualified allocation plan, so every 2 years we update it. We were in the process of going out for public comment with the qualified allocation plan. So we thought it was timely, in light of what had happened with these tax credit properties, that we would ask in a public comment period, what do you think that we should do about rent increases and whether people who get low-income housing tax credits should agree to limits on increases in rent? We heard back probably more comments than any public comment period in a qualified allocation plan we had ever put out, and we heard back very strongly on two ends of the conversation. Renters and advocates told us absolutely we should. The owners and developers of properties, both for-profit and non-profit organizations, told us the hazards of doing something, which said to us, don't do anything rash. We have to be very thoughtful about what we do, and we did nothing. So what we did last fall was we asked for public comment, but the qualified allocation plan was approved by my board and is being signed off by the governor, hopefully very soon. Does not do anything that changes the rules around rent or rent increases in our low-income housing tax credit properties. I believe that we're not going to see a 12% increase in the area median incomes. I believe that HUD now understands what the impact is when Treasury just takes data that HUD publishes and what the impact that is on residents of tax credit properties. But I have no reason to believe, I mean, I can't believe the area median incomes went up that much during a period of time that people were hurting so badly. But they did. But it's not just math. I mean, it's seniors' lives. It's people with disabilities' lives who live in these properties. So, you know, I feel like it is incumbent on me as the housing commissioner and the manager of these low-income housing tax credits to at least understand whether there are some things that we should do to limit the possibility of there being a 12% increase in the future. But common to some misunderstandings in the field, we did not implement any policy changes We simply solicited public comment, which is our due diligence when we are making a decision around a new qualified allocation plan. I hope that answers your question, Senator.
Senator Draheim.
Thank you, Chair Port, and thank you, Commissioner. We've had a lot of great discussions, and I know you're very passionate, as am I, about housing, and I look forward to working with you in the future. Thank you.
Chair, Senator, thank you very much.
Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate the conversation we've had this afternoon. So it's my understanding that you are self-sufficient in terms of your agency admin costs. So my question for you is, if the legislature were to fully fund your agency admin costs, that would allow you then to take what you're currently expending and pass it along as savings to those who use your services. So what would that result in as an interest rate decrease? And again, those who are using your mortgage services.
Commissioner?
Chair Port and Senator Lucero, thank you for the question. I think this is more of a thought exercise than a proposition, but let me give it my best. Agency earnings pay for more than just agency operations. A large portion of it does fund the down payment assistance that is behind our first-time home buyer lending program. It also funds capacity building and financing gaps in capital projects that we're involved in. We used agency stuff to guarantee a mortgage for a manufactured housing cooperative in Worthington while they were arranging financing. So there's a lot of different things that we can do with it. So it's not, there's a lot of flexibility there. I mean, I think, you know, my understanding just in conversations across the administration is that funding agency operations doesn't always feel like the most glamorous thing that the legislature can put money into. And so the question for me is, do we have a deal in perpetuity, because my obligations to bondholders go into perpetuity with the life of the agency? And so, you know, I guess my concern would be that this legislature can make decisions for this biennium, but will the next legislature understand that going forward, or will I be in a situation where I'm fully funded to implement a Go Big package today, but some of that funding is rescinded in future years, and we'll never have a surplus of this magnitude in the one-time infusions of money into housing? Certainly, looking at interest rates, looking at below market interest rates, and other things that we can do is a part of agency operations all the time. And when people are doing something in the housing space that is less profitable, we make sure that we size the cost of tapping our resources to the activity and its likelihood of being, you know, well, even breaking even to the people who are willing to do it. But I just think the model that we have, as I said, is recognized as one of the strongest housing finance models in the country. My goal from day one is, if it's not broke, you know, don't break it, right? And it's, you know, I'm relieved after all of the capacity challenges of the last 4 years that we're still considered to have this one of the strongest housing finance models in the country. So I guess my question back, Senator Lucero, would be, you know, why would you want to mess with something that is so highly regarded?
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Lucero?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Madam Commissioner. It's, again, just a brainstorm to see what we can do. Just because something's always been done that way doesn't mean it should always necessarily be done that way in the future. And thinking outside the box, exploring what opportunities we might have in order to pass along the greatest savings at the least amount of cost, obviously, to those that are utilizing the service across Minnesota. So again, thinking outside the box.
Chair Port and Senator Nocero, I'll take it back to my leadership team to noodle on the answer, but I do think the nice thing about our finance model is that it is evolutionary. It's not something that's the same today as it was 10 years ago, as it was 20 years ago. but in fact, it's stronger than it ever was. And so my goal is to leave it in a better place than I left it. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Bolden?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Hill, for your time with us this afternoon. I personally try to keep in mind, as we are doing this work in public service, how the policies that we talk about and the work that we do connects with and is an affecting real people. And so you alluded to this a little bit in talking about how you went to a community with Senator Abler, but I'm wondering if you could talk just a little bit about how you ground yourself or how you stay connected or thinking about how the work that you and your agency is doing, how that affects people's lives.
Commissioner?
Chair Port and Senator Bolden, thank you for the question. When I first came to the agency, one of the things I asked my leadership team is, please never send me to a listening session with a PowerPoint. When we go into communities to listen, we need to listen. Some of the days I remember best from my pre-pandemic time as a commissioner was sitting in the living room of somebody's manufactured home down in the southern suburbs, packed tight with other residents, talking about things that they would like to see in our manufactured home repair programs, and being the only person in the room who didn't speak Spanish, but understanding loud and clear that folks really needed what we do. I mean, some of the biggest changes for me professionally was when I went from being corporate managed care executive to working at Hearth Connection on homelessness. It's one thing to say it's an interesting mathematical proposition that people who are homeless are expensive to the healthcare system, and if they're adequately housed with the right services, they will be less expensive to the healthcare system. It was another thing to meet people who had been homeless for 5, 10, 15, 20 years who were suddenly having an opportunity to radically transform their lives because they were given a key and a case manager whose first name they will remember for the rest of their lives, and the opportunity to have such a radical turnaround in their own lives. At first year as commissioner, I was visiting Three Rivers Community Action and learning about our work on first-time homebuyer counseling. And there were three new homeowners there, one who had closed on their house the day before and come in. I mean, my guidance to the agency is, yes, we need to be listening to the people who use our money to create housing, but we constantly need to be listening just as much to the people who need our housing or use the things that people develop with our funds. And we need to be listening not just in the metro area, we need to be listening whenever we're out, and we need to get out as much as we can. It's been interesting. I mean, virtual statewide meetings were actually uniquely interesting in the period of time where we didn't gather in large groups in person, because actually people who never would have driven to a listening session with the commissioner could actually, you know, click onto Zoom. And we had actually a lot of participation by people who never participated in before. And I hope that we don't just go back to one way of listening. I think the other thing I learned at Hearth Connection, but probably hammered in deep during my period in Washington, D.C., is that when you're trying to get money, whether from a foundation or from the legislature, you always try to go in and tell them how great you are. But if you only understand what you're good at and you don't confront who what you're doing doesn't help, then you will simply, you know, help the people that it works for, but leave the other folks behind. And I think one of the things I'm proudest about my time at Hearth Connection is that, yeah, we came up here and we talked about our success with 85% of the people that we housed remaining stably housed 2 years later. But back home, we talked about the 15% that weren't. And what was it that we needed to do differently so that the folks that we had intended to help but weren't helping could achieve the success that the folks that we were helping were. And so, you know, I've taken that into my work in Washington, D.C., the culture of a lot of federal agencies, especially when they're talking up, is to only talk about what's working. But if we're going to really tackle big problems, we always have to be asking ourselves the question, well, who is it not working for? And so I think in the work of our agency, understanding that the tax credit 60% of AMI rent limit works great if you make exactly 60% of AMI, but it doesn't work if you make 50, 40, or 30% of AMI, has made the agency focus on how often can we buy the rents down in deals down to 50 or 30% of AMI, because the tax credit doesn't work for those households. In the work that we're doing ending veterans' homelessness, we have to, be glad that only two counties have yet to receive a federal designation that they've created a system that can effectively manage veterans' homelessness, prevent veterans' homelessness, but we have to stay very focused on Hennepin and Ramsey, as well as what's happened in the other counties after they got the declaration, after they had the big event. I think, easy problems are solved. The hardest problems are intersectional, and they're usually pretty tricky. But I've found a lot of satisfaction in working in that space, because when you actually can figure out a different way to get a different result, especially for folks who haven't believed that there was ever anything out there that was going to work for them, it's incredibly satisfying. So thank you for the question.
Thank you, Commissioner. I will call on Senator Rust for a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair, in great appreciation of the work you have done for the state of Minnesota and in anticipation of even finer work the next 4 years. It is my honor to move to recommend that the appointment of Jennifer Ho as Commissioner of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency be confirmed and sent to the Senate floor.
Discussion, members. Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. It is my delight to send the commissioner's confirmation to the Senate floor. Commissioner, thank you for taking your time with us today. We appreciate your willingness, not just today, but throughout the year, to engage with all of the members, answer questions, and work together to solve the problems facing Minnesotans. We are very much looking forward to an overview next week of the governor's budget proposal, which I think we have all agreed there are big problems facing us, and we are excited for a big solutions kind of day. So we look forward to that. Members, to let you know, on Thursday we will be hearing two bills, Senate File 234 and Senate File 22. I will be testifying in another committee, so Vice Chair Bolden will be chairing that committee. With that, no other business before this committee. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.